We have a lot of work left to do. We've got less money to do it with, and we've got a changing environment to do it in.
A new challenge for sanitation systems in rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 13th of January. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, a state council assesses Alaska's suicide prevention efforts.
The environment has changed. There have been a lot more open conversations, both formal and informal.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Help manage subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide critical advice to the Federal Subsistence Board on the management of subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing on federal public lands. The deadline to apply is February 18th. For more information, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
There are still 4,000 homes in rural Alaska that don't have access to piped water or sewer. Many more are using aging systems that need upgrading. And an unlikely culprit, climate change, is forcing government officials and engineers to look at using new technologies to correct the problem. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Bill Griffith is a program manager with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. He says 45 villages and rural Alaska don't have basic sanitation systems, and solving that problem will not be easy.
We have a lot of work left to do. We've got less money to do it with, and we've got a changing environment to do it in.
Griffith participated in a workshop in Anchorage this week, organized by the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and the Centers for Disease Control. The idea was to bring health experts, climate change experts, and sanitation engineers together to take a fresh look at the issue of providing basic sanitation in Alaska's rural Arctic. Water and sanitation may not seem vulnerable to climate change, but Griffith says rural systems are already seeing the effects of warming. He says changing vegetation patterns in many areas have allowed more contaminants to leach into water sources.
In long-time water sources, where we might have had less treatment required in the past, we're seeing those changes result in increased treatment needed. The kinds of filtration that was installed there 10 or 20 years ago are no longer adequate, having to come in and look at different ways of treating that water that we didn't need to do in the past.
Experts only expect the problem to get worse, and that has people like Griffith looking for new solutions, especially as funding gets harder to find.
We have systems that are increasingly unaffordable to construct and operate, and we only see that problem becoming bigger in the future. So as we have challenges trying to fund existing technology, and communities have that same difficulty, I think what we're realizing is that technology has to be part of the solution going forward.
That's where Peter Jensen comes in. He's a professor of environmental engineering at a university outside of Oslo, Norway. Jensen is an innovator in the field of wastewater treatment. The Norwegian Polar Research Institute asked him to build a treatment system for their expanding base in Antarctica, where any discharge is illegal. He came up with a system that separates out solid waste.
And that's utilizing the sewer separation, where we take away the excreta, treat that in one treatment train, and then we treat the rest of the water from washing, showers, and so on in another treatment train. And that way we can make a very efficient treatment with very, very low emissions.
Jensen's convinced the same type of thing could work well in rural Alaska, and he says it's a system that would be more resilient as the climate changes because solid waste isn't getting mixed into the water cycle. But Jensen says a one-size-fits-all approach won't work.
So, I mean, we have to take the best from what we know today and combine this and then tailor solutions to the different little settlements and to the varying conditions you have, whether they're close to the sea, whether it's flat area, whether it's a permafrost or it's not permafrost. So we need a variety of systems.
Cheryl Rosa helped organize the workshop for the U.S. Arctic Research Commission. She says she wanted to get people who normally don't talk to each other together to share ideas. Rosa says climate change is presenting a lot of new challenges to water and sewer systems in the Arctic, and the stakes are high.
Villages that don't have water to homes that are using typical honey buckets are only partially, they only have partial provision of water, maybe on kind of traditional more like hall service, have a higher incidence of illnesses such as respiratory illnesses like pneumonia and RSV.
Rosa hopes this week's workshop is just the beginning of a long conversation and then action, making sure all Alaskans have access to basic sanitation. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
A new sobering center opened this week in Bethel. The building will provide new ways for the community to deal with inebriates, and many are hopeful it will free up emergency services for those that truly need them. KYUK's Shane Iverson was at the opening and has this report.
Okay, they come in this door. They'll come through this door and come to this area right here, and we'll process.
This is Rusty Tews. He'll be running this place soon, but today he's giving tours to media, local and state leaders, and about 65 people that came to celebrate the facility's grand opening. Most are mingling in the large sleep-off room.
We'll assign them a mat. We come through here, we'll assign them a mat, and they'll either, the ladies will be on that side, the men on this side. We're going to observe them from these windows.
It's only been 3 years since we came together in November of 07. There was a call to arms.
Bethel Representative Bob Heron speaking before the crowd.
Basically, the community realized, the region realized, the Health Corporation realized, everybody realized we had a problem. And the problem was inebriates in our community and how we deal with them.
By law, enforcement officers must take someone into protective custody if they're considered a danger to themselves or others. But how to handle them has clogged up the local hospital, the local jail, and taken precious time from Bethel's already busy police force. Chief of Police Larry Ellerton says his staff is excited about the new center.
So instead of spending 2 hours for every inebriate, that's obviously going to get cut down now.
Ellerton says the reason it can take up to 2 hours is the cumbersome system in place. Right now, police or community service patrollers will pick up an inebriate. Their first stop is the ER for an evaluation. If there's no room at the jail, the drunk will stay at the ER, where they essentially waste the resources of space and staff who should be treating medical emergencies. The system is not just frustrating, it also fails to address the sickness of alcoholism.
It's been my goal that we give these folks safe, respectful treatment.
Tews recalled riding along with a community patrol officer when they were called to pick up a drunk young man.
He's belligerent when he got in the car. When he got to the hospital, he started telling his story. He's 18. It was his birthday party. His friends got him drunk, and he started being terrified. He went from belligerent to, I want my mom.
But the next trip was to the jail, and there, the guards have their own procedures to follow.
And when he hit the jailhouse, he walked slower and slower. When he got in the room, they immediately put him prone on the floor, face down, his hands behind his back.
Tew says the sobering center staff will have their own procedures.
We're going to meet him at the door. We're going to treat him respectfully and get him through the system and into this room where he can sober safely with some dignity.
The whole mood of the intake and sleeping center will be geared towards intervening after the individual sobers up. Steve Williams with the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority says that not everyone is ready for help, but some will be.
If we can intervene sooner and educate and reach out and support some of those folks, we hope will prevent from becoming a chronic abuser.
The sobering center will be open 4 days a week from Thursday through Sunday. Tew says information from the Bethel Police Department shows that calls for service spike on the weekends. Staff will consist of 2 to 3 people with medical training, at least one EMT, and an AAT, which is similar to an EMT but with less training. The building can house up to 18 inebriates on foam sleeping mats. Again, Rusty Tews.
This place is safe, but it's not a motel.
The bare-bones facility was relatively inexpensive to build, at least by rural Alaskan standards. The price tag came in at $1.9 million. The funding came through the state of Alaska through 2 legislative appropriations. The Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation managed construction of the site and will manage the center once it's operational. YKHC says it will open its doors to the inebriates on Tuesday, February the 1st. For KYUK, I'm Shane Iverson.
The Center for Biological Diversity is planning to sue the Interior Department over land designated as critical habitat for polar bears, saying the designation doesn't do enough to protect bears from the effects of oil and gas production. The 187,000 square miles along Alaska's northern coast and in the Arctic Ocean was designated as critical habitat in November. The Interior Department is still authorizing oil leasing in the area, including a potential exploratory well that could be drilled this summer in the Chukchi Sea. Rebecca Noblin, director for the Center of Biological Diversity office in Anchorage, says the suit is a way to ensure the Interior Department is sufficiently protecting the polar bear under the Endangered Species Act.
This is just a reminder to the Interior Department that the designation of polar bear critical habitat triggers a duty on the part of the federal government to ensure that it doesn't carry out or fund or authorize any actions that could harm the polar bear's critical habitat.
Oil production in critical habitat areas isn't illegal, but the Interior Department is responsible for ensuring activities don't take place that would harm the bears or their habitat. Bruce Woods, a spokesman for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska, says allowing oil exploration in a critical habitat area isn't unusual, and the Interior Department has successfully allowed it before in the Arctic.
We have had critical habitat for threatened eiders in some of those areas for a considerable amount of time now, and we have worked with industry on exploration in those areas.
The polar bear was listed as threatened in 2008 under the Endangered Species Act, due in large part to the projected loss of Arctic sea ice. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an adventurer attempts to become the first man to climb Denali solo in January.
I got a few aches and pains. It only hurts when I'm sitting up or laying down.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
An annual report by the statewide Suicide Prevention Council shows Alaska Natives continue to have a high suicide rate despite millions of dollars spent on the problem over the past decade. But the report also indicates a new willingness to discuss the once taboo subject, and that may be the beginning of finding solutions. Kate Burkhardt is the executive director of the council. She says improved communication is the foundation for developing more effective strategies to reach the goal of fewer suicides.
The big difference in the landscape now is that while there continues to be stigma and concern about talking about it, people seem to be showing a lot more courage and being open about the fact that, you know, this has happened in my family, this has happened in my community.
The council was established 10 years ago by the state legislature in response to a rash of suicides. Its duties include providing information about the suicide prevention system in Alaska and improving the overall health status of Alaskans by reducing suicide and the impact of suicide on individual families and communities. A suicide prevention summit held a year ago pointed to a disconnect between state, tribal, and community suicide prevention efforts. Although this year's report avoids drawing conclusions, Burkhardt says it is pointing to a future direction in which members of the public and prevention specialists will help implement a statewide plan.
How the council does that is through public awareness and public education by supporting and enhancing suicide prevention services and programs throughout the state with a variety of stakeholders and partners all over the state.
A new web portal, StopSuicideAlaska.org, could help connect stakeholders. Burkhardt says a shift in how mental health grants were awarded over the past decade had a direct effect on small community programs, which were squeezed out by larger health providers with greater staffing resources.
In the early part of the decade, small grants easily applied for were awarded to communities all over the state. And then in the middle part of the decade, there was a shift to a more professionalized prevention system utilizing the strategic prevention framework. And with that shift came a much more complicated grant process.
Smaller entities could not compete for grants in terms of management and reporting requirements, and funding went to more regionalized entities. Burkhardt is quick to note that the municipality of Anchorage actually received some of the lowest levels of funding during that time period, and that funding is not a question of urban over rural.
While the funding that's been available in the last couple of years has been substantially more than used to be available between 2000 and 2005, 2006, the number of grantees has actually dropped to about half.
The Council's report is the most recent attempt to highlight suicide prevention in the state. A legislative report released this past November pointed to skyrocketing rates of suicide among Alaska Natives and attempted to find underlying causes. That same month in Anchorage, federal BIA representatives hosted a public discussion about suicide among Natives. Burkhardt says being willing to listen to a person in trouble and showing that each life is important is something that everyone can do to help with suicide prevention. The second jury trial of Rochelle Waterman has been moved to Anchorage. That was the decision at a pretrial hearing held in Ketchikan Superior Court yesterday morning. Waterman is accused of conspiring to kill her mother in 2004. She was 16 at the time of the murder. Her first trial, held in Juneau, ended in a hung jury. KRBD's Maria Dudzak reports.
Superior Court Judge William Carey made the decision to move the trial out of Ketchikan after reviewing survey results and hearing arguments from the defense and prosecution. In December, questionnaires were mailed to potential jurors to gauge whether an impartial jury could be seated in Ketchikan. Judge Carey summarized the results, saying more than 50% responded guilty, probably guilty, or definitely guilty. He says another 36% responded not sure, don't know, or have no opinion as to the question of guilt. He says of all who responded, 53% had a strong opinion as to guilt or innocence. Before making his decision, Judge Carey asked for arguments from both sides. Waterman's attorney Stephen Wells says in making a determination of change of venue, possibly guilty and not guilty responses should also be considered.
Doubt that if we spent a whole bunch of time, we could get 12 people plus the number of however many alternates that the court wants that would say, you know, I can be a fair juror. But Alaska law says that that's not enough. When you start getting into numbers like that, even if you get people in the jury box that say, you know, we can do this fairly and impartially, Alaska law says we have a real question.
Wells argued that it would be easier to seat a jury in Anchorage and court space would be available.
Anchorage is a large enough city. There's enough of a turnover in the population that while I don't doubt that there's going to be jurors that know about this case, it's going to be at a percentage in which the Court of Appeals has said that, you know, we can get fair jurors and there's not a presumption of prejudice.
Prosecuting attorney Stephen West grudgingly agreed.
I mean, I would prefer to try to get a jury here in Ketchikan, but the court's got the statistics. I think it would be difficult to get a jury here.
Waterman is accused of conspiring with Craig resident Brian Riddell and Klawock resident Jason Arendt to kill her mother in November of 2004. Both men pled guilty to first-degree murder in 2005. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
The Alaska Native Brotherhood and Sisterhood have changed their minds about Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell. Southeast's oldest Alaska Native organizations decided to drop their objections after meeting with Campbell last week. Bob Loescher heads up the organization's subsistence committee.
We found her willing to take a look at community economic development. She was willing to look at the sea otter issue in southeastern Alaska, and she was willing to take a hard look at community fisheries.
ANB last month announced it would try to block Campbell's appointment in the legislature. It accused her of being biased toward commercial fisheries and against subsistence. Campbell used to run the Petersburg Vessel Owners Association and worked with the United Fishermen of Alaska. ANB and other Native groups have clashed with the state over traditional harvests. Subsistence Committee member Rosita Worrell says those at the meeting agreed the time was not right for a full review of that conflict, but she says Campbell was open to discussing a variety of fish and game issues.
She said very directly that it was her objective to work to restore the trust in ADFNG, and she recognized that very often ADFNG had an adversarial relationship, and she wanted to work to overcome that.
Worrell, a Sea Alaska Corporation board member, chairs an Alaska Federation of Natives committee working on subsistence. She says Campbell has been invited to address AFN. Native leaders outside Southeast also raised concerns about the new commissioner.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD. Paper applications are available at the same 270 statewide locations as last year. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Oil is leaking at a rate of less than 2 gallons a minute from a feeder line at the Trans-Alaska Pump Station 1. Response crews are using a vacuum truck to suck up the oil as it accumulates into the basement of a pump house where the leak was first discovered last Saturday. A three-day shutdown that followed ended Tuesday night when the pipeline was restarted to prevent system-wide freeze-up problems. A fix for the leaky feeder line is in the works. A 157-foot pipe to bypass the bad line is expected to be installed during a 36-hour shutdown planned for this weekend. Starting tonight, Alaskans will get a chance to give their opinions on a plan to nearly double the size of military training ranges around the state and the Gulf of Alaska, and to train more late into the night with aircraft, artillery, and missiles. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
U.S. military leaders say they need more room and better facilities to enable realistic training with both Army and Air Force units in order to fight and win 21st century warfare. So the Alaskan Command is proposing changes that would expand the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex, a 65,000 square mile mosaic of training ranges and airspace scattered throughout the interior and eastern Alaska, mainly around Eielson Air Force Base and Fort Wainwright and Fort Greeley. The military proposes to expand airspace now designated as military operations areas and create more such restricted airspaces and corridors between airfields and training ranges. It seeks new ranges and facilities that would enable ground units to train with the Air Force for both high-tempo and high-tech electronic warfare, as well as smaller-scale guerrilla-style combat. The proposals would allow more joint Army and Air Force training exercises, some with artillery and missiles, and some that would be held year-round and late into the night. Alaskan Command spokesman Air Force Captain Uriah Orland says if the proposals get final approval, expansion of the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex would begin in about 3 years. Orland says the expanded range complex would allow all the armed services, especially those based in Alaska, such as the Army's Stryker Brigade and aircraft out of Eielson and Elmendorf, to conduct expansive, realistic training.
So the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marines, and even Coast Guard are training together to bring economic efficiencies. It brings more realistic training that we actually do in combat so we can train the way we fight.
The proposals also would incorporate a new 58,000 square mile training area in the Gulf of Alaska into the range complex expansion. That area would enable naval vessels to participate in joint exercises and train for anti-submarine warfare. Orland said in an interview last month that the area east of Kodiak Island will allow fighter aircraft stationed at Elmendorf to conduct annual training relatively nearby, instead of on the other side of the continent.
The F-22 pilots have an annual requirement to fire a live fire missiles to stay proficient in that. Currently, they have to go to Florida to do that, which means we take our F-22s from up here and we fly all the way to Florida to do that training. One of the proposals is that they do that over the Gulf of Alaska.
The military says Alaska is the only place in the United States where a complex of training ranges like this could be designated because of the vast areas here with relatively little population. But to account for the likelihood that some who live around the ranges may not like the maximum amount of training time and space requested by the military, the proposals also include lesser alternatives. For example, a proposal on nighttime training includes alternative to permit use of airspace until 11 p.m. during March and October, or a maximum alternative that would allow activity until midnight, year-round. In cases where the public raises too many objections, the military would simply not change existing training times and areas. Members of the public will get their chance to comment on the proposals in 7 public meetings to be held around the state over the next couple of weeks. The public comments are required as part of the environmental impact statement the military must complete before it moves ahead with the plan. The first meeting will be tonight in Anchorage. The next one will be January 19th in Delta Junction, then 2 in Fairbanks on the 20th, then Healy on the 24th, Talkeetna on the 25th, and back to Anchorage for a final meeting on the 26th. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Minnesota adventurer Lonnie Dupree reports making it to the 11,500-foot level of Denali and starting up the steep pitch known as Motorcycle Hill on the mountain's west buttress route this morning. In an audio blog posted yesterday, Dupree sounded optimistic about his climb.
Spirits are high. I'm feeling good about everything. The weather's been pretty good, a little windy. I got a few aches and pains. It only hurts when I'm sitting up or laying down. Otherwise, I'm feeling pretty good. The old bones are moving forward.
Dupree is trying to become the first person to solo climb Denali in the month of January. He's sleeping in snow caves to hide from the wind and cold and walking with an aluminum ladder to protect him in a crevice fall. The 49-year-old has extensive polar experience but minimal high-altitude climbing time. He scaled Denali for the first time last summer. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Tim Ellis in Delta. APRN's Andy Fisher reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, based in Alaska's interior, growing across the nation. One answer to our state's declining oil production, Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough. When you file online for your PFD, you can donate to any of the 91 organizations that help Alaskans pull their lives back together after an emergency. Get more with your PFD when you pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation and the Mat-Su Health Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.